Welcome to a new episode of the Activism Academy podcast. I'm Miriam, and if you're not already tired of my voice, I'm really impressed. Today, we are joined by the founders of Boltiband, Trinata Lukder and Jana Vijayant. Boltiband is an Indian-based organization that aims at building a new type of dialogue through which we can really listen to the side that is quite unlike us. Welcome to a new episode of the Activism Academy podcast. Today, not only we have our two guests, but we also have a new co-host, which you haven't met yet, dear listeners. Pallavi, if you would like to say a few words about yourself.
Hi, everyone. My name is Pallavi. I started working with KII about 2 months ago. It's been a really interesting journey. I come with experience across the board of a lot of different things, mostly related to youth development, peace building, countering violent extremism, and it's really exciting working with KII. Thanks, Mary.
Thank you, Pallavi, and welcome on your first ever experience as a podcast host. And now to our guest, would you like to please introduce yourself and your work?
Hi, I'm Janvi. I am currently dialing in from Bangalore, India, where it is unnaturally cold. I am the co-founder of Boltiband, and I'm here today to talk about listening, healing, and depolarizing dialogue. For my day job, I work in mental health care as an editor.
Hi, I'm Trina, and I'm Janvi's co-founder at Boltiband, which of course we'll be talking about a lot more later on today. I am dialing in from Rajasthan, in India, where it is also very cold, but it's actually a desert state. So at night, it gets super duper cold and it's been raining. So I guess we're all in that kind of weather mood today. But also, along with Boltiband, I run a nonprofit in Mumbai where we work with underage girls from the red light area to empower them with education and leadership support so they can go back to their communities and bring change. So these are the Boltiband, and this are what I spend my time on.
So how did you start to identify yourself as change maker? What experiences in your life brought you where you are now?
I can go first because my story involves my co-founder. I was a wee 15-year-old when I walked into the office of this organization called Ashoka, where Trina used to work. And I just walked in there because I wanted a job because I was bored and I was homeschooling, and I thought working would be fun and cooler than going to school. But I got there, and Ashoka has this tagline that says everyone a change maker, and I vividly remember sitting on the rooftop terrace of this office space and listening to that tagline and saying, well, if everyone is, then I must be one too. And then I started working with Trina very, very closely. We worked together at Ashoka for I think 3 years, also became best friends in the process, and then a few years later started Boltiband. And there was a lot in between, but that was my change maker story. It was just, you know, all of us have it in us to be change makers, so why not me?
And so for me, I think the school I went to played a big part in me self-identifying as a change maker. So I actually grew up in Nepal, and I was going to this school in Kathmandu. And from a very young age, they would take us volunteering, first in the neighborhood low-income schools, but by the time we were in like middle school, we were trekking to outside of the valley and working with children there. And we were like a no plastic school, and we would stitch cloth bags together. And now looking back, of course, they're little things, but I think what it ingrained in me is that I have some kind of power to change things, to do something. It is in my hands. And I think that thought stayed in my mind, and I've always felt like that going forward. That when I felt like there was an issue that I felt very strongly about, I had that sort of faith in myself that I could do something about it. And that's what identifying as a change maker is.
I think that sounds really wonderful, right, Miriam?
Yeah, absolutely. I find your message, especially taking change into your own hands and that everybody can be a change maker, what the Activism Academy is also about.
Exactly. And I think what really stands out for the both of you, at least when I'm listening to it, is that, you know, it was a journey that started in your teenage years or even earlier, sort of feeling connected with society and feeling connected with and being part of a larger system. And I think that sort of very organically brings us to Boltiband. And I guess the question for the both of you from my end is that, you know, tell us how the idea of Boltiband came along, starting with what Boltiband means, because we have an international audience with Activism Academy, and why Boltiband. And yeah, how do we find ourselves? And now it's been what, how many years now since Janu? I don't want to like sort of broadcast your age out there, but if it was 15, then we're almost at what, 7, 8 years since?
Yeah. 8 years. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's an 8-year journey, and now the both of you are doing something really fantastic together. So, yeah, all yours. Tell us what Boltiband is all about.
Oh, well, Boltiband, I like to translate into two ways, into English. It's a Hindi phrase, and usually if I'm going for a shock factor, then I say that Boltiband means shut up, which it does, but it also translates into speechless or quietening oneself or quietening the other. But the message that we were really going for is, you know, shut up and listen. It's time to listen and not keep listening to the sound of your own voice. My journey with Boltiband, to Boltiband, I guess for me it really started when, in college, I used to go to this nomadic college where every semester 150 of us, again, like we started out as teens, young adults, from over 80 different countries, we would travel to a new city and a new country every semester and live there and work there and study there. And this sounds very exciting at the outset, but once you get into it, a few months in, you realize that a lot of cultural differences start climbing in. And initially, they're just the small ones like, wait, you don't brush your teeth before like drinking your morning coffee. What the hell? But then they end up like crossing into how consent is interpreted or how early you start learning about consent. Or, you know, what is considered sexual, what is not. And, you know, across what is considered holy or what is not. And how do you even think about religion, right? So a lot of these boundaries started getting crossed, and a community that once like thought that it was going to be really tight-knit, and it did start out to be that way, started fragmenting. And along this time, a bunch of us started experiencing various incidents of sexual harassment and assault. I myself did as well. And so a bunch of us women from a few different countries, I think some from a few countries in Africa, some from Europe. Yeah, I think we covered the world there. We started doing drunken wine night Wednesdays. And a lot came out when we were there just for the camaraderie and for being there for each other. But what came out mostly was how we were willing to extend compassion to those that, you know, didn't understand consent, and why those boundaries were being crossed and why the fragmentation was happening. But at the same time, I was having these conversations with my parents back home, with a bunch of people back home, and they did not go down so well because, you know, there was a lot of attacking. There was a lot of, you should have taken care of yourself better, and victim blaming and all of that. So for a long time, I was very disconnected from the family, and I felt very victimized by them as well. At this point, I saw that there were either two options. One, violent conversation and communication, or complete silence. And that did a super turn on my mental health. So I knew that there had to be a third way, and that third way had to be rooted in healing. And I started studying neuroscience, and that's where Boltiband's idea came in of how to depolarize dialogue and healing. Oops, so sorry about that. And then Trina, my partner in we started.
So I think my journey was very similar to Janvi's, but just a different context. At the same time, as she was doing these dialogues in her college, I felt like I couldn't have conversations about issues that were really important to me, like gender, politics, religion, with people who I was really close to, my close family and friends, because the disagreement would become so aggressive, and it was basically be polarized dialogue. And it was important. I mean, and the best case scenario seemed to be, let's not talk about it at all. that's how we can remain friends or family. Like, let's never talk about this again. And that to me just wasn't a good enough best case scenario. I wanted a way to be able to speak to people I cared about issues I cared about. And I think that's when Janvi and I sort of started talking about it. And actually, funny story, the first time Janvi actually told me about the idea of Gothiban and she wanted to start working on this, we were in Istanbul for New Year's and we were on this long walk up a hill. And I heard her and I said, that's really interesting. And I've been thinking about it as well. But I don't really think it's my calling in life. So have fun. Good luck. Do it. You have my moral support. But less than a year later, we had co-founded Gothiban. So Gothiban, the origin stories, it came from a desire to be able to have meaningful conversation with people we disagree with the most.
I think, thank you so much both for sharing, you know, your stories, actually even gifting those stories. I think it takes a lot of courage to sort of share that personal connect as to why we do what we do. And I'm deeply grateful that you sort of put that out there to both Janvi and Trina. Thank you. I think what stands out for me in terms of what you're saying is connection, right? Like something that both of you really sort of, that was a red thread, was that, you know, there's this culture of silence on the side of, especially, I mean, it's no coincidence that they're, from my perspective, that the two people who are talking about listening as well as talking happen to be, you know, people who identify as women, because there's such a sort of silence surrounding, you know, that, you know, thing. And for me, what really stands out is A, that desire to connect, for connection, which involves speaking your truth. But what I also sort of hear you saying is that it also involves just, you know, being quiet and listening to someone else's, right? And so I guess my next question to you is twofold, that, you know, what are you hoping to sort of achieve through this project? And, you know, why do you believe that it's important?
I'll take the first half, you take the why it's important.
Yeah, exactly. Always on the same plane.
Okay. So the core idea behind Gothiban is this, which is that, so when we break down what a polarized dialogue is, we realize that it's a conversation about what we believe in. Right. So let's take an example, the farmer protests in India, for example, and to give a very brief context, if any listener is not aware of it, but the Indian government was trying to pass these farm laws that the farmers believed would be very bad for them economically and for farming in general. So for over a year, thousands of farmers were protesting on the borders of the capital, Delhi, and to protest these laws. And there were people who were claiming that, there's foreign funding and intervention just to cause rioting and violence in India. And of course, then there was a lobby that believed the farmers. And then there were those that were like, no, the farm laws are good. They just don't understand it, etc. Right? Okay. So if any two people were having a conversation about the farm laws today, what would we talk about by default? I would say that I believe the farm laws are actually really great for farmers. It will actually increase their income. They just don't see it. And someone on the other side of the spectrum would say, no, you don't understand. The farm laws would impoverish the farmers even more. We already have so much farmer suicide. This would kill them, etc. What are we talking about? We're talking about what we believe in, right? I believe the farm laws are good. I believe the farm laws are not.
Right.
And whenever there's a conversation about what, it becomes a I'm right, you're wrong conversation. Right. And this seems to be the only mode of conversation we seem to know to have as a society on issues. Right. And the moment there's that I'm right, you're wrong paradigm, that is bound to become a conflict and just aggravate and becomes polarized. Right. And so we said, OK. And also this form of conversation is not just polarizing. It's actually ineffective because no one ever walked out of a debate saying, oh, I get your point now. Thanks. I understand you. Like, that just never happens. So it's an ineffective mode of conversation. And so we said, okay, how can we have this conversation about this issue that's not a what conversation? And at that time, we also studied a lot of what was going on in the conflict resolution space globally, but of course focused in India. And one trend we found is that a lot of the field in this space is saying, let's find common ground. We'll all be familiar with this language, right? Let's find common ground, common ground. Now, what does that mean, right? Here's an example. So in India, we've tried a lot of these experiments where we say like Hindu women and Muslim women will run a tailoring center together because they are divided on religion, but we find this common ground of they want economic livelihoods. And if we can find that common ground, then, you know, we've basically solved this conflict of religion between them. Which is all great, but if a riot does break out or if there is a religious conflict, the fact that they were running the tailoring center together doesn't stop the violence, right? It's because we've actually not talked about religion, which is what's dividing them. We've found this common ground. So in a sense, we said, okay, so what do we have to do at Bodhipan? We have to find a way of talking about what the uncommon ground is, what we disagree on. And we have to find a way to talk about it that's not in a way of what we believe. Right? Because that is going to polarize the dialogue. So that's when we said, okay, instead of that, what if we could talk about why we believe what we do? What are the life experiences we have had that have brought us to this belief today? Right? So let's go back to our example of the farming laws. And what would that conversation of why what we believe look like? Right? So I will share, for example, I believe these farm laws are not going to be good because I've actually grown up in a farming family and I have seen these experiences, or I had the opportunity of living on a farm for this amount of time or with this farming family and I had these experiences, right? And maybe the person on the other side would say, but I studied economics and theoretically the farm laws actually make sense and this is my experience of studying and I've studied in these elitist Western philosophy economics colleges perhaps, right? And that's as valid an experience as growing up in a farming family to have this opinions. And now, once we are able to have that conversation about our life experiences and why we believe what we do, we don't have to agree still, but it is very difficult to come back to someone's story about growing up in a farming family by saying, you are wrong and I hate you and you don't deserve to live in this country and, you know, all physical violence in so many situations, right? Because if you think about it, when we say we are depolarizing dialogue, when we say polarization is the problem, what do we mean? We don't mean that disagreement is a problem, right? Consensus is a myth. As long as there will be different people in society, there will be different opinions. And we need different opinions so we can have dialogues and have progress, right? If we all thought the same, there would be no progress or change. The problem is not therefore a difference in opinion. The problem is today our extreme reactions to someone with a different opinion. Today we're saying just because someone thinks differently, they don't deserve to live in this country, you know, you're a bad human being, legally, they're legally punishing them for having different beliefs, right? In so many cases, like I said, physical violence. So it is that extreme reaction to a difference in opinion we're trying to solve for, not the disagreement itself, right? So then our end goal is not that there'll be consensus and everyone agrees. It's just that we're able to have a conversation to which we don't respond to with hatred.
Right.
That's the end goal. And so that's the, and so I think Pallavi, your question was like, what is it all towards? It's towards this. For us to not hate or marginalize, discriminate a person who has different beliefs from us.
Got it. Thanks, Trina.
That's a wonderful place to pick up from. You know, why is this important? And I go so far as to say, like, this may be the most important thing we need to crack in the 21st century, because I like to look at it from two angles, right? And Trina spoke about these as well, from the individual's perspective and from a societal perspective. From a societal perspective, I mean, it's fairly apparent. We seem to be able to, you know, not converse about anything, and almost everything needs, like everything that needs social progress today needs conversation, whether it's vaccinations, climate change, all of it needs conversations. It needs us to be working together to move forward. Without this, we're, I mean, not to be that person, but we're doomed, right? Like, this is the only way we're going to be able to work together. It's only if we have these depolarizing conversations. And from the individual level, you know, the way that we think about trauma or healing, I think everybody knows and everybody talks about how trauma can stem from these sociological differences, from these political differences, from oppression, from all of these environmental factors, right? But then when we get to addressing that trauma through healing, it's always some kind of individual effort. There's therapy for you, or there's your own mental health journey that you need to take. I mean, mental health is the epidemic nobody is talking about yet. Not enough, at least, right? And even if we are talking about it, we're talking about each person doing this for themselves. But right. That just fundamentally doesn't solve the problem. I mean, the trauma is coming from these interpersonal relationships. It's coming from these socio-political dynamics. It's intergenerational trauma, right? Like I read this super fascinating study a few years ago about how the tendency to be corrupt, or the tendency to be self-serving in a situation above people serving, is a lot more common in countries that have been colonized in the past because of the trauma inflicted upon them through colonialism, where they had to be self-serving in order to survive. And now that colonial hangover, I mean, there's all kinds of colonial hangovers with, you know, skin type and sexuality and all of that. But also this, a tendency to be corrupt, which is hurting so many people real time today. And everybody's talking about that, but nobody's seeing it from a trauma or a healing perspective. And as long as we focus on healing, which is not to do with differences, which is not to do with micro-conflict, which is not to do with connection, we're never really addressing the real problem. So why is this so important? It's important because we really need to heal as individuals. And we need to heal as a society to be able to do anything at all and survive this century.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think I can sort of hand it over to Miriam as well, because I think she has really interesting questions about this in terms of just highlighting that collective and individual tension, right? I think that comes out so superbly that you're trying to sort of navigate and figure out how do you sort of bridge, almost like a funambulist, walk that tightrope of individual action and collective sort of transformation. So yeah, Miriam.
Yeah, about this, how are the people responding to what you propose? How has your journey been? Are the people engaging? Are they willing to try and challenge themselves with the new type of dialogue?
The people that we've worked with so far, I think what's been beautiful, and I'll go back to what I said before about individual and collective healing, that is at the core of why people are willing to take this journey or engage in this dialogue. It's so interesting. We've seen, you know, in these sessions, in these conversations, whether they're curated and facilitated by us or whether they're individual conversations we've had or, you know, individual conversations that other people have had and then they come back and share their experiences with us. The mandate or the mode of conversation that we always start out in, as Trina was saying earlier, is one of I am right and you're wrong. And in that mode of conversation, everybody is almost cornered into having to defend themselves and cornered into having to attack and not listen. But once we're able to break that cycle with just one person, it takes one person to break that cycle of saying, I'll shut up now and I'll listen. Why do you believe in what you believe? They automatically undergo a healing experience. This is the cognitive, it's got the same cognitive effect that healing, like in therapy, has, for example, right? It's got exactly those same changes. But that person goes through the change of not having to come from a space of anger or fear or trauma, and they automatically start engaging from a place of kindness. So in real time, they're feeling better about having listened. And because they've extended that first listening ear, the other person's guard is let down. Now they don't feel cornered and they don't feel the need to attack or to defend. And they start then engaging. They return the favor and they start engaging by listening first. And that shift happens to them as well. So we've really seen how, you know, in every conversation, the mood shifts from people being tense and angry and like on edge to suddenly like this room of people that didn't know each other before just like being really sweet and kind to each other and, you know, talking about things that they never thought they'd realized before. And it all happens because that internal transformation is so simple and it's rooted in like them feeling healed in that moment.
And the other part I'll say to answer how the response has been is Subhotibandh is unfunded. And we are, just one example is we are running this fellowship and we have 12 fantastic fellows who are basically training through this fellowship to be facilitators of dialogue in their own teams and communities. And So Janvi and I are doing part of the workshops in the fellowship, but we also have 5 external facilitators who have different methodologies of dialogue coming in teaching. And none of it, there is no monetary exchange anywhere. Everyone is gifting their time and their minds and their passions to this, which really shows us that they are doing it because they think it is that important. So that's a huge indication of the response from people.
And this is the second cohort. There's also mentors that have been in our network for a long time who are helping these fellows. The first cohort of fellows, the first cohort of, you know, partners, there really has a community somehow has formed itself purely by believing and, you know, believing that this dialogue is important and engaging with it and realizing that they want this for themselves. I think that's been our strongest indicator.
Could you share with us some examples of conversations that have come up, difficult conversations, and how you have been navigating through them?
Good. Yeah, we can share. Maybe I think we can talk about some of the designs of our workshops, how we do the workshops.
Yeah.
Maybe, do you want to?
Keeping confidentiality in mind.
So,
like,
yeah. And we can maybe share like personal experiences, but we can begin with the design. So Trina already went through this, right? The fundamental core of the dialogue is you move from what I believe in, to why do I believe in this, to the third stage of why do you believe in this, right? So the third stage is where you start really listening to the other person's experience. And we have, you know, 5-6 different designs that we've worked with over the past 2 years, but fundamentally, this is the thread, this is the experience thread that we try to take our, participants through in every design. So we begin with, either a simulation or a debate or a simulation where, you know, they're playing the role and they're playing like roles of 2 opposing people. Our most common characters have been a mother and daughter talking about sexual assault and this daughter having gone through an incident and wanting to report it and the mother being starkly against it. And we go through the initial part. So the workshop is always, or the session is always split into 3. And the first part is just, you know, letting people run loose, because we all know how to debate. We all know how to defend our views and try to convince the other person. It comes naturally. But then we then reflect as a collective on how that makes us feel, how we think, you know, that would have made the characters feel, or, you know, how do we empathize with those characters, empathize with ourselves, our own experiences. And the general consensus, I will actually say always has been that it feels horrible to be in that space. That it is mind-numbing, traumatic, it induces anxiety. We've seen, you know, people start to visually tremble. I myself, when like facilitating these workshops, I have felt the tension in the room, like getting too much to handle. That's the first part. But then as we take them through the second and the third parts, again, it depends on the design, like the way that it's structured. We notice that by the time we come to the third part, while continuously reflecting on, you know, our emotions and on our relationship with the character, their emotions, on our reflections on the emotions of the other side, we notice that by the end of it, everyone is in a calm state. And everyone is a little more peaceful, and they're trying to, like, they're talking about the other side's emotions and perspectives a lot more than they're talking about their own emotions or perspectives. So that's generally how this conversation goes. And when I've had it personally with family on, you know, mental health, sexual assault, sexuality, religion, a lot of religion conversations, caste, all of these, right, with my family and community here, it's always started off with like fights and them telling me that I need to respect my elders and not question their beliefs. But it ends with amicable conversations and a lot of learning and growth on both sides. And we've, you know, personally, I've come really far in my interpersonal relationships with these people because of this dialogue.
I think just listening to what you're saying, also sort of what stands out for me is a lot of the times when we get into conversations that sort of challenge our beliefs or challenge our values, right? Either you go into a defensive mode or you want to just get out of there as soon as possible, right? Very rarely do we find a frame that allows us to sort of work with the person through the discomfort, to come onto the other side through that tunnel, where on the other end, despite like, so it's sort of almost learning how to regulate that discomfort, how to get comfortable with that discomfort, right? And I don't think there are enough frames within our educational system or within society for that matter, that enable us to, unless you come, like you're going to a really hoity-toity school and have, you know, hoity-toity access in that regard. But yeah, I think that really sort of stands out for me. That just, I mean, I know for a fact that when you're facilitating and you start feeling that tension, just having a co-facilitator in the room with you is so reassuring in that regard. So I can only imagine when, you know, being with so many other fellows, and having that camaraderie and that community towards the end of it would probably be quite an enabler for them as well.
And Pallavi, if I can just pick up from what you said about, you know, our education system or any systems for that matter, don't prepare us to be able to have this dialogue. So just to pick up from that and talk about what we exactly do at Bhortivand. And let me start from the fact that you're exactly right, that none of our systems model this. So how are we supposed to learn it? So one of the levels we want to work at is to create content that models this kind of behavior, right? So, for example, if you go on our website, you'll see a series of articles covering an issue from the perspective of two people who disagree on it, but their stories of why they disagree. Right. So, for example, Janvi's written a three-part series on Israel and Palestine, which is the story of an Israeli person and therefore what they believe, and of a person what they believe, etc. Right. We also hosted a podcast series ourselves. Actually, one of our fellows from the first cohort of 2020 started a podcast series which was called What We Don't Understand About Dash. And basically, every month, the Dash, so for example, one of the months is What We Don't Understand About Politics. And we had the official spokesperson of the BJP, Shweta Sharan, the official spokesperson of the party in power in India, talking about politics and her career in politics, right? And the whole point is, you don't have to agree with her, but if you really want to understand what politics is, you have to listen, right? And you don't have to agree. So the podcast was one way to do that. The articles are in. And so we want to create more ways that people can see this, read it, have it available, so we even know what we are modeling towards, right? Okay. So that's one level Bhortivand works in. Then a level under that is then basically building capability / infrastructure within organizations, within movements, to build spaces, dialogue, right? Which is what the fellowship very much is for us. So everyone in the fellowship already works in the space of dialogue in some way or other. They're either liaisoning between governments and NGOs, or they're bringing policymakers together to have dialogue. So in some form, they're all engaging with dialogue. And but, you know, some are trying to do it with data, some are, and we are basically lending our methodology to them to strengthen their work, right? So this is our other level of work, which is institution building. And then, of course, our ground level work is we do direct workshops with groups of people we call politically active, which doesn't necessarily mean in elected politics, but it means anyone who sees themselves as having a role as a citizen in a democracy. And so that's our ground level work, and these are the three levels we work in. And I think all three are important to aid, like I said, to start by modeling that behavior and then giving tools to actually then be able to practice it.
So what I also hear you say is just sort of two things, right? It's like, one, really disseminating that skill through and through all sort of levels, if I'm looking at it from that perspective, and making that skill extremely readily available as sort of just being there, right? Accompanied by curiosity, which I think would be the feeling that that skill is all about, cultivating, right? That if I want connection, then I need to cultivate curiosity. If I need to understand dialogue, then I need to cultivate curiosity. So it's almost like a twofold thing that's trying to happen simultaneously while you work across all three sort of levels, for the lack of a better word, simultaneously. So I'm also looking at the time, and I'm like, this conversation, I think at the rate that it's going would never be a never-ending thing. But I think my question sort of comes to organically that what are some of the challenges that you're anticipating in this work, in the short term or in the long term?
Oh, okay. I think, you know, personally and, again, individual level, collective level challenges, but individual challenges, I think, for me have been two big things. One is just the capacity to continue holding this space, right, and continue, like, doing these sessions or, you know, thinking about, so because this is hard, like, it's a lot of emotions and regulation and all of that that you need to hold at a time for, like, 15, 30 people. And we always say this as well to, like, anybody who goes through the dialogue, is that this is not something that you need to engage in or do all the time. I mean, there are boundaries for yourself, and if you're listening to others, it's equally important to listen to yourself as well. So, you know, to be able to get to the point where we have enough facilitators out there, and that's sort of also one of the goals with our fellowship this year, is each of these fellows can also go out there and become facilitators. I think we're going to need a really huge number of people who are able and willing to persevere and hold these conversations, because anybody who begins will need to pause at a certain amount of, after a certain amount of time and step back. Like, this is not something that, you know, you can be at it for years. But the other thing is, you know, Trina and I are both upper caste, urban educated, fairly privileged, I'd say very privileged women, right? And we've had a lot of global exposure. We have immense social capital. So while this dialogue, you know, at the fundamentals of it, it is based in evidence, it's based in psychology, it is a very human thing, and therefore is, you know, it applies to every human being out there in the world. The contexts around the application are so sensitive and so unique to every, you know, to every bit, right? So, like, even within India, I don't think we're equipped enough to be able to have a conversation, say, about caste or even about religion, right? Because we also, I mean, this is, again, my opinion. I think we belong to the more privileged religion here. So I think that's another constraint, in that we're going to need facilitators, but facilitators from all kinds of backgrounds, from people who know their contexts most to be able to do this, because you know, we shouldn't be the ones to be holding these dialogues, or some people like us shouldn't be the ones to be facilitating these dialogues in all contexts. So I think personally, those are my biggest, challenges. And I think on a collective level, I see a lot of people still opening up to this and seeing the need for this and seeing the need for healing and connection. But it's a slow process, and a process that's being, at the same time, like, you know, if we're David, there is the Goliath of, like, fascism around the world. There is the Goliath of people really trying to incentivize polarization. There are all those tech companies that work on incentivizing polarization, right? There are politics out there, the ruling class of the world that works on incentivizing polarization. So, you know, how much of this can be organic and can continue to sustain itself until, you know, one day it just doesn't? That's my other big fear.
Trina, if you just want to add really quickly, like, what I
asked. I think Janvi really covered it. Yeah? Covered it all. Yeah. Those, I would put those as top three for sure.
You started to talk about how the situation globally also is. So your project, of course, has been modeled in, and it has came into light in India, where you have very specific cultural needs and very specific cultural aspects that you address every day. But could your project be remodeled for a global audience? Could it work at a global level?
Absolutely. I believe that our theory of change, if I can call it that, which is that if we have dialogues about why we believe what we believe instead of just the what, then we won't have extreme reactions to difference in opinion. That theory of change is issue agnostic. That it can be applied to anything. And for example, in our first cohort of fellows, we had an American fellow who's a Black Lives Matter activist. And she saw the application of this form of dialogue between law enforcement and the protesters, right? And you can see why that dialogue would, and, you know, beautiful things came out of that dialogue. So I absolutely think that it translates across borders, issues.
I would like to add, though, that, you know, the word you used, you said, would this approach be globally applicable? I think our theory of change is globally applicable, the dialogue is, but I'd say that the approach, again, would have to contextually differ. And not just in that someone from within that conflict will need to pick up the baton and hold the space for this dialogue, but also in cases of extreme violent conflict, I think there's a lot of scaffolding of other kinds of conflict de-escalation and resolution work that needs to be done around this so that we can arrive into a room at least to speak about, like, you know, to hold this dialogue. So, yeah, like Rina said, the theory of change is sound. It's human. So, I mean, it's for all of us. But I think the approaches will have to be nuanced and differing across the globe.
I definitely agree about that, especially considering how each and every one of our country, even in Europe, where our motto is united in diversity, we have so many differences and things to be mindful of, even between just here and 100 kilometers away. And I also very much agree that the world really needs to step down and listen, especially listen to people that have different opinions and not get every different opinion as a threat. That's something I am guilty of doing myself. When somebody disagrees with me, I tend to feel attacked all the time. So I guess I need to learn to. So we have one last question for you guys before you leave us. We have our traditional last question, concluding question at the Activism Academy, which is, do you have a film or a book to suggest to our listeners that would like to delve more deeply into the topic?
Yes. Please go to www.voltiband.org and you will find a beautiful book on the homepage called The Unheard Table Book. And this book starts off explaining about Voltiband a little bit, which, of course, now that you've heard this podcast, you know. But then it goes into articles by sector experts on why this dialogue is so critical across sectors. So we have a lawyer talking about why this skill is so important in the legal field to solve legal matters. We have someone who works in active politics talk about why this skill is so important for people in elected politics. So on and so forth. And this book, most excitingly, ends with a DIY toolkit on how you can try and have these dialogues on your own. And I'm also very biased towards how beautiful this book looks, which is all credit to Janvi. But I would definitely say, go check it out. The Unheard Table Book.
Sounds fantastic.
Tina has taken care of the plug. I will go outside of our little universe. I don't have a particular film I do have a book, but I don't have a particular film. But I will say that I think since we've started, both people have started, like, immersing ourselves in these dialogues, what's really stood out for us is films or narratives that are very rare and very scarce, and you're going to have to look for them. And sometimes, you know, it's very hard to even count them on, like, two hands. But I'd say, like, look for films where perspectives are being shared without judgment. And perspectives are being shared in whole raw vulnerability, but there is no trace of, you know, preaching, or there is no messaging at the end of it other than these are all the perspectives and these are, like, abundant perspectives and there's always more to learn from these perspectives. And I've really found myself, like, watching those kinds of films and engaging in those kinds of series or literature more has been helping me have these conversations better, because, like Gina said, it normalizes this for you and it makes it that much more accessible and available. And my personal Bible, this book that I have been that I was introduced to a few months ago and I have been reading every single day, I pick out a sentence and I make it my motto for the day. It's this book called The Courage to Be Disliked. And it talks about healing and it talks about trauma. And it is, I think, revolutionary in terms of how people think about connection and healing and listening. So definitely check that out.
Thank you so much. I think I'll just take 2 seconds, Mary, where I think this podcast was especially sort of special for me. Because A, it's the first one that I'm doing, as Miriam pointed out at the beginning. And the fact that it started off with the both of you. And I think that will always be extremely special. Needless to say, I think what Bolti Bund is doing is something really incredible. Getting people to engage from a lens of curiosity in our current world, I think, is probably the most smallest but most poignant revolution that you could probably put out there in terms of introspection and self-reflection. And I know for me, it has been a really interesting hour of just learning and understanding and being sort of blown away by two amazing women who have dialed in from two different parts of a very big country. And I really, really appreciate the time. Miri?
And Pallavi, there's a third reason that this is very special, which our listeners don't know about, which is that you have been engaged with Bolti Bund before it existed as an organization, when it was just an idea and just a conversation. And you have been instrumental in everything from shaping our narrative to checking our punctuation on our content. And you've helped us with everything through this journey. So that's why it's so special to be able to do this podcast with you.
You're being too kind, but always there to support. Really amazing stuff. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, everyone, for your time and for joining us. And also, thank you very much for all the knowledge you have been sharing with us.
Thank you. Thank you. It was lovely to be here.
Thanks for tuning in and making it this far. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and we are excited to upload the next ones in the coming weeks. Stay tuned through our social media channels on Twitter and Instagram. See you soon!